A new poll finds Angela Corey and Matt Shirk in deep trouble heading into next week's primary election. The director of the Kummer Museum abruptly resigns. And new information revealed about the doomed El Faro's final moments. Some of the stories making headlines this week. Good Friday morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Melissa Ross. We are always live at 9. Make sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes and the WJCT app and watch the show now too. Video on demand with our partner, TVJax.com. You can get on the line now and weigh in on all the news of the week with our Friday Media Roundtable, 549-2937. Then later, we're going to ease on down the road with a local production of the Broadway classic, The Wiz. Plus, St. Augustine gears up for the Sing Out Loud Festival, all of that ahead. But first is Friday, and we're going to recap a very busy news week as we welcome Paula Horvath of the Florida Times Union. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
Claire Goforth, editor at Folio Weekly.
Good morning.
WJCT reporter Lindsay Kilbride.
Good morning.
And our own analyst, John Burr.
Happy Friday.
It is a happy Friday. If you've got that Friday feeling, join the conversation. We've got a lot to talk about. New information about the El Faro's final moments. Also, a surprise resignation from Kummer Museum director Hope McMath, causing lots of talk. But we begin the hour with our top story. Just as a new UNF poll finds incumbents Angela Corey and Matt Shirk in trouble at the polls, a new study also was released this week from Harvard finding that Duval County is an outlier when it comes to aggressive use of the death penalty. Get on the line now with your thoughts at 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online to wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect. Email, tweet the show, weigh in on our Facebook page. Paula Horvath, let's begin with you. The Fair Punishment Project at Harvard Law School says just 16 U.S. counties, including Duval, are responsible for the vast majority of death penalty cases in this country. Your thoughts?
That's right. The report came out was the result of a number of months of looking at the data, and it was brought on by a Supreme Court dissension that mentioned the fact that there were so many death penalty cases coming out of so few counties. It's about 16. This was the first report that covered the first eight. The second report will cover the next eight. Duval County had the distinction of being number two in the nation with 25 death sentences being given out between the years of 2010 and 2016. So it was after Angela Corey became state's attorney.
Now, Angela Corey was booked to appear on this program yesterday. She canceled, and in her place, we spoke with her two top assistant state attorneys. Mm-hmm. Here is Prosecutor Bernie De La Rionda taking issue with the details in the report. Let's listen.
This report acknowledges, reluctantly, that there are zero people on death row from Duval County that are innocent. So I want to stress that. All the people in Duval County that have gotten the death penalty are guilty. There's no issue as to their guilt. And that is an important thing for your listeners to understand. So we should get a little bit of credit for that, mm-hmm. that there are no exonerations here.
Claire Goforth, the report cited three factors leading to Duval's status as an outlier, what it called overzealous prosecution from our local state attorney, ineffective counsel from the public defender's office. Of course, public defender Matt Shirk is facing a tough road to reelection himself, and racial bias in the system.
Yeah, the report was very damaging for the justice system in Duval County, undoubtedly. These issues we've been talking about for years. People have had the perception that Angela Corey's priority is winning, not justice. And she's
Which
she disputes, but she does very clearly state again and again how much the victims matter to her and the victims. And she's very well known, and she's pretty beloved by victims' advocates. But you have to admit that there's when you're seeking the death penalty, it's not just about the victim and the sympathy that you have for them. It's also about what is the right thing to do. And when you're looking at statistics like 48% of these people have either low IQ or severe mental health disturbances or physical and sexual abuse in their past, I mean, and their ages, they're being so young as well. I believe it was about the same percentage was below the age of 25 and a significant percentage were below the age of 21. You have to ask whether it really is the right thing to do to continuously pursue the maximum penalty, which is death in these cases.
And John Burr, Bernie DeLoriand on this program yesterday said the vast majority of families who've been victimized want the death penalty for the killer of their loved ones. Of course, one notable exception to that is local mom Darlene Farah. Her daughter Shelby was killed. The Farah family asked that the death penalty not be applied to Shelby Farah's killer, and the state attorney's office proceeded anyway. The other day on WOKV radio, Angela Corey said she felt that the family was more interested in seeking publicity than gaining closure. That was a controversial remark. And as we move ahead and look at the polling in this race and the public defender's race, there have been a series of controversies that have dogged the current state attorney, and that her well-financed challenger, Melissa Nelson, has been able to capitalize on.
Oh, yes. And, I'm sure we'll talk about the polls in a minute, but, the other side of this whole thing with the state attorney's office is the ineffectiveness, according to the study, of the public defender's office and chronic underrepresentation or bad representation of their clients. And, you know, when you put, as the report says, when you put an overzealous prosecution and you team it up with a public defense that's not effective, you're going to get some pretty high numbers of people going on death row.
And it's 549-2937 to join us. Lindsay Kilbride, let's talk about the new poll from UNF's Public Opinion Research Lab. A stunning lead for newcomer Melissa Nelson in the state attorney's race. She's out in front of Angela Corey, 52% to 20%. Wes White, the third contender, at 7%. And then in that public defender race, Matt Shirk is trailing badly to retired Judge Charles Cofer, 43% to 21%. Early voting is already underway. The primary is Tuesday, but these two incumbents are facing a very tough battle to be reelected as it stands right now.
Yeah, that's right. And if they do change, it's going to be, if they both do not win, it's going to be a huge change. But I think we still need to look at there is that 20% that's undecided. And I know in the poll, about 13% of people said they had voted. So there's still that, you know, big portion of people who haven't voted yet. So I think there's still time to tell who will be elected. But it's pretty damaging for Corey, particularly because she's definitely more in the public eye right now rather than Shirk and Cofer.
And, you know, Paula, we've also seen this striking phenomenon of somewhere between 5,000 and 6,000 people changing parties specifically so that they could vote in the closed Republican primary. Anecdotally, we're hearing because of these two races. And whether that will make a difference in the final tally, we'll have to see.
I'm hearing that a lot, and I can't imagine that 5,000 to 6,000 people wouldn't make a difference. And it's not only in Duval County, although certainly this race has really made that happen in Duval. It's also happened in Clay County, where the Van Zandt race has encouraged people to switch over to the
parties.
Republican side. And it's this whole idea of having write-in candidates come forward and then being able to close the election. So I think maybe we need to be looking at that rule.
Mm-hmm. Claire, that's been challenged at the state Supreme Court, and challenges to change that have failed more than once, is my understanding.
Yeah, that's very true. But the voters at this point seem to be really disillusioned with this process that allows these write-ins to go and close the race. And it happened in Nassau County as well. I believe that it was about 3,000 people
the superintendent's
race between Atkins and Birch, I believe.
Burns.
There. So is that what we want for our election system, where if a candidate would just want their party to vote. They have some of one of their friends or someone they know file as a write-in with no real intent of campaigning or winning the election at all, just to make it, to close it to voters from the opposite party.
Lindsay.
And I think in the debate that was pretty clear that when Corey is asked about this, she doesn't really take ownership of it, is the argument on the other side. That's what Nelson alleges. And, you know, what Nelson calls a dirty trick, Corey calls it's the law, and sort of says, you know, it's, you know,
and it's
unfortunate. Yeah,
it's, right. It is a dirty trick and it is the law.
So, but she doesn't. She won't claim that. She won't claim a part of it. And I think that's what makes people think,
and
who is this person?
And, I'm sorry. And let's also put a bit of the blame on the local Democratic Party for not fielding any candidates.
I know, in neither race.
Yeah.
Well, it's not just the local Democratic Party. The Florida Democratic Party is in shambles right now. But let's take a look at the sea change that's going to happen here, if the polls are being believed, with Angela Corey voted out, Melissa Nelson in, and Shirk voted out. I mean, talk about a popular indictment of the local, you know, of the local justice, you know, coalition here. I mean, good gosh, that's amazing.
I was practicing law in 2008 when they both ascended to office, and people in the legal community were rather put off by the close relationship between the public defender and the state attorney.
Right.
When they ended up winning, we were all concerned that it was going to affect the administration of justice in Duval County, and now 8 years later, it has, according to the report by Harvard.
And let's go to your calls right now as our Friday Media Roundtable looks at the top stories of the week. What are your thoughts? Join us at 549-2937. Chuck in Jacksonville Beach is with us. Hey, Chuck. Happy Friday.
Good morning. Good morning, guys. I voted yesterday. I voted for John Rutherford and Melissa. I voted for John Rutherford because he's a great man, but also because he's against the death penalty. And I wanted to comment on the death penalty. They talk about the victims. I'm sure that Ted Bundy's mother is a victim. She wasn't planning on that. And what do you do with a 13-year-old child whose father's on death row, and she knows that he's going to be executed in a week? What kind of PTSD is that going to cause to that 13-year-old child? So I think we have better options for the death penalty, like the Quakers up there whose schoolhouse got hit, and they went and ministered to the family of the shooter. Thank you for letting me share.
Sure, Chuck. Thank you. You know, Paula, I do believe nearly 60% of Americans in this country still support the death penalty to a point. However, use of it is declining, as we said at the top of the hour, in most counties, with the exception of Duval, Hillsborough, Pinellas, and Miami-Dade. They are outliers in the nation, and a few other counties, including a couple in Alabama and Texas and Arizona. What about his call?
Well, I think one of the points that the Harvard study makes is that the 16 states or counties that are pointed out as having higher than other counties' number of death sentencing cases, it actually goes against kind of a national trend, which is away from the death penalty. In fact, a very recent study that came out just within a couple weeks said that 57% of the people in Florida actually were more in favor of giving someone a life sentence than giving them a death sentence. So I think it's even changing in this state.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting. I can remember a time in not too distant past when there was a litmus test for anybody running for governor in the state of Florida. And the litmus test was, will you, you know, put people on death row? Will you have them executed? And if you said no to that, you were not going to be the governor of Florida. Now, you know, this, I'm talking 15, 20 years ago. This isn't ancient history. So, you know, we have come a long way as a state in terms of being more lenient on the death penalty. But we're still behind the national average. There's no question about that.
Lindsay.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting to talk about the victims' families because De La Rionda?
Yeah.
Say? Okay. Because, you know, he often talks about the victims' families.
Sure.
And the point that they want.
This is what they want.
They want the killers killed the way their own, you know, child was killed in a brutal way, and they want the worst. But he doesn't really talk about the other side, which is the parents who don't want to go through this. You know, the Shelby Farah, for example. And I think another part of it is the cost part, which I think a caller called about yesterday. And I've been to a couple debates about the death penalty. And it is that it does cost a lot of money for all these appeals. And Rionda's solution is to get rid of all the appeals and push it through faster. But on the other side, there are groups like conservatives concerned about the death penalty who say it's not fiscally responsible and it's also not pro-life. And so there are other parts to this. I don't know. I just think it's interesting.
It has emerged in recent years as part of a larger conversation about what some might call smart justice, that whole movement. But let's go to a few more of your calls at 549-2937. Karen at the Beaches. Hey, Karen, how are you?
Hi, Melissa. Good morning, and TGIF to all of you.
Yeah, you too.
Thank you. I appreciate your shining the spotlight on this issue, and I have many thoughts on it, but I'd like to start with the assistant from Angela Corey's office saying that all of the cases where the death penalty was handed down, all of them were guilty. Oh, well, great. You know, that's a whole nother issue when they receive the death penalty and they're innocent. So, but, you know, I mean, that's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about that Duval County is so very high in handing down the death penalty. My opinion is that it's barbaric, and, you know, why does it even exist anymore? You know, that's my opinion. And also that the whole punitive system needs to be overhauled. And I agree with the gentleman that was talking about the Quakers and how they reach out to the family. You know, we need more of that. Also, so many death penalty proponents advocate pro-life. You know, they're against abortion. And, you know, I'm not saying I'm pro or against, but, you know, let's be fair here. If you're going to judge whether to take somebody's life, you know, then let's be on the up and up about it. I don't think anybody is you know should have that right. So anyway, those are a few.
Yeah.
My feelings about
Karen, thanks for that call. Karen in Jack's Beach. Paula.
Yes, and I think talking about Angela Corey's assistance, his statement about everyone who is on death row from Duval County is guilty. I think a lot of times exonerations don't come until many years later. We have had, and I think that's one of the reasons that people around the country are becoming dissatisfied and with the death sentence. There have been, since 1973, 26 people exonerated, let go from death row in Florida alone. 26 people. The latest was 2015. So it is ongoing. I don't think we can necessarily state that every one of these death sentences is for a guilty person.
Susan in Fernandina Beach. Hey, Susan. Good morning.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I just have a couple questions, and I'll take my answer off the air. I wonder if your panel could talk about they were talking about cost. So how much does it take to keep one person on death row versus the alternative? One, also, that these people that are in prison for whatever, and they did get the death penalty, I mean, they are getting housed, fed, sometimes educated. I just was wondering if your panel could talk about that, and I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Okay, thank you for that. And according to the Death Penalty Information Center, cases without the death penalty cost an average of about $740,000. Cases where the death penalty is sought, about $1.26 million. So that is the argument against the death penalty in terms of the overall cost over time. Claire.
You know, just last year, I had to look it up because I didn't want to misstate it, but just last year, Bernie DeLaRionda said that he'd like to bring firing squads back to Florida because the cost of drugs are getting so high to execute people. And he's specifically quoted as saying, bullets are pretty cheap and they're very quick. I mean, if that's the kind of judgment that we want people that are in the position of deciding whether or not to execute, to seek execution of those charged with murder to have, then that's the kind of justice system that we will have. I think that people now, we're looking at this from a more measured place. We're not just wanting to reactionary go after the death penalty, but it's worth noting that the majority of Americans and Floridians support the death penalty. I personally believe that's because of cases like Charis Periwinkle. It's because of the most heinous crimes against children and because of serial killers that for individuals such as that, a part of us still believes that they do not deserve to walk this earth. But for people that are convicted and executed for a drug-related murder, who are 21 years old, who have extremely low IQs and have a history of abuse, do those people really deserve to die in the system of justice that we have? I mean, that is the ultimate deprivation of freedom.
And we're going to keep taking your calls, but move on and discuss a few other news and notes from the week. As we move along, we want your calls now about this story because there was a lot of discussion this week in Jacksonville about Hope McMath. McMath abruptly resigned her post as director of the Kummer Museum of Art and Gardens to much speculation about the cause. Now, McMath had recently been quite outspoken about a series of incidents she said had racist overtones against the Kummer exhibit LIFT, Contemporary Expressions of the African American Experience. And Lindsay Kilbride, LIFT was inspired by Jacksonville native James Weldon Johnson and his brother, who penned the incredible anthem of Black America, Lift Every Voice and Sing. In recent months, Hope McMath had been increasingly vocal on social media about the pushback, the backlash to LIFT. I think the question on the minds of a lot of people who follow the arts and culture crowd in this city is, was her vocal expression, did it play a role in her resignation? Did she willingly resign? Was she pushed? I think that's what is being asked this week.
Yeah, and those are speculations. I don't know. I've spoken to her several times. I know she says she wanted to continue some of her work outside of the walls of the museum, that she wanted to, you know, and also at the same time, there were big fundraising campaigns happening and construction projects. And, you know, she's a trained arts educator and all that, and that's where her passion is. So she told me she really liked finding out through doing these exhibits like LIFT, which it's a contemporary take on the song. So there are pieces in there that probably make people feel uncomfortable. You know, Chip Southworth has some that really tackle the subject of Black men being killed, and it has, you know, words like "I was wearing a hoodie," "my music was too loud," things like that. So I'm sure things like that make people feel uncomfortable. The typical Kummer audience who isn't used to this sort of thing being in their museum. But she told me she likes the way art can help change a community, can spark conversation. And some people think art is just beautiful, and some people think it's something that can be difficult. And I think that's something that the community as a whole needs to figure out how, I don't know.
How to deal with it. And let me just jump in really quickly. As I learned in reading today's Times Union, Paula, a local mom of four kids, two white, two Black, met with some folks to get this exhibit put on at the Kummer because she has such different experiences walking around town when she has her white kids with her, as opposed to when she has her African-American kids with her, and they have experienced a lot of issues as a multiracial family, and she saw the need to start a meaningful conversation about race in this community. Paula Horvath, your thoughts about that?
Well, exactly, and I think that's exactly what the exhibit is meant to do. It's meant to make these issues, meant to make art personal as well as cultural, that you can walk into a museum and feel something personally because you see pieces of yourself, pieces of your own life, pieces of society that you're familiar with right there on the wall. And this isn't the first time that an exhibit at the Comer has tackled race and the divisions within this community. And of course, McMath really believes very fervently that art is all about inclusiveness. So I think this is a disturbing outcries from the community about.
There's been a lot of concern movement. About a resignation and suspicion that perhaps it was not as cut and dry as it looked.
Well, you know, clearly, you know, we talk about the average comer attendee, what they want to see in their museum. You know, when I think of Hope McMath, I think of somebody who's expanded the comer audience. I think that, you know, through these types of exhibits, she's brought in a whole new bunch of people. I think the attendance is up 50% or so since she became the director. So, you know, she's done a lot of good for that. For that museum and for the city of Jacksonville.
Now, there are two schools of thought about this, Claire. One, that Hope McMath has certainly moved things forward in this community. The other school of thought holds that if you're representing an institution like the Comer, you don't have carte blanche to spout your opinions on social media, especially if they're controversial, that you will face reprisals for that.
Well, that's the Jacksonville way, isn't it? I mean, Hope and I sat down yesterday. I wanted to talk about everything that had unfolded. And she had a lot of enlightening things to say, some that I would share and some that I wouldn't, perhaps next week in Folio Weekly. But, I mean, Jacksonville is basically run by 12 rich old white people, okay? And they get what they want. And when you come out like a Hope McMath or like a Don Emrickson, over time it wears you down because you keep having to fight to pursue, you know, expanding the arts to people. I mean, do we want art to be only for elite white folks, rich people, or do we want it to be for everyone? Do we want to challenge the things about ourselves that make us uncomfortable? And that's what Hope was doing. And I think a lot of people admired her a lot for that. And some people, it made them uncomfortable. So they were saying, no, let's not do it. But she did say very clearly that the majority of her board was completely supportive of her and that she is leaving the Comer with a positive feeling.
Paula.
Well, I think it's interesting that there's so much divisiveness over this particular exhibit because this community, Jacksonville, has a wonderful history of African-American contributions to the community. We have music. We have art. We were the Harlem of the South. Jacksonville was an amazing place, and we should be reflecting that.
And Lindsay. We were to be Hollywood as well, and then people got tired of it, and away they went.
I think that moving forward, whoever...
Those darn Hollywood people, they caused all the trouble. No. Lindsay.
Who wants to be Hollywood?
I think moving forward, it's going to be clear. It's going to send a clear message to the community who they pick to take Hope's position. If it's somebody who is like Hope and has the same ideas as Hope, not... you know, a complete copy of her, but, you know, someone who is more on the progressive side, or if it's someone who wants to revert Comer back to what it was, you know, years and years and
so
years ago.
So if there are any rich old white guys looking for a job,
time will tell what the Comer's future holds.
I think one reason that her resignation has struck such a chord is there is real tension in this community between younger, more forward-looking people who are trying to move on a range of issues and what might be referred to as the old guard of this city, who is very traditional and is uncomfortable with some of these social changes. That tension, you see itself play out over and over again, and this is just the latest example of that.
Sure, and the HRO is probably, in the political sphere, is the most obvious example of that. You know, Jacksonville is a very conservative town. I mean, I've said this a lot, but, you know, with the influx of people from other parts of the country over, you know, that conservatism, especially on social issues, is getting diluted more and more and more. I would say we're a little behind in terms of, you know, that evolution. But, having been here a while, I do see progress.
In what way? In what way do you see it?
well, the fact that you have a Hope McMath in that position of power and putting on exhibits like this, this never would have happened in, you know, Jacksonville 2000 or Jacksonville 1990, you know, not a chance.
And Brian writes on our First Coast Connect Facebook page, please name the 12 old white people that run this city. Thank you. Claire, I believe that was your comment.
I believe it was my comment. I don't know. Those
actually,
are very
only
powerful
eight.
People. I think one's last name starts with an R, but I'm not sure. I'd have to look at my notes.
Let's go to Mark in Mandarin. Hi, Mark. I think you're calling about something else, but good morning. Hey, Mark, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Hey, go ahead.
On the county referendum number one, I can't tell from reading this, and I've heard conflicting things as to whether it takes effect in 2016 or 2026. But on the half cent, on the half cent thing with respect to elimination or the Better Jacksonville half cent sales tax, from now until 2016 or 2026, whenever it is that this thing goes into effect, would the half cent Better Jacksonville sales tax continue to go to Better Jacksonville in the interim, or would it or would it start going right away to the pension plan?
Yeah, it's thank you for that question, Mark. Paula, John Burr, it's my understanding that until 2031, the half-cent sales tax will keep paying for the Better Jacksonville plan stuff.
Yes, and that's longer than originally forecast. But, you know, that's because the sales tax didn't bring in the money that they thought it would.
Okay. Let's talk quickly about... Lindsay, go ahead.
I just wanted to add, we have a very detailed explainer on
WJCTnews.org.
And we have a video also on our Facebook that answers lots of questions on referendum one. And
there you go, Mark.
Everything.
Go to WJCTnews.org for all of that information. And almost 26 hours of audio recordings were recovered this week from the doomed El Faro's data recorder, shedding light on the ship's tragic final moments. NTSB investigators are examining the recordings right now. Now, in the early hours of October 1st last year, El Faro's 33 crew members found themselves stuck in the Atlantic with a Category 4 hurricane bearing down on them. They had sailed from Jacksport right into the storm. And Paula, the data recorder has revealed that they were ordered to abandon ship at 7:30 a.m. 10 minutes later, the audio recording ends. And so very sad news.
Very
to
sad
learn
news.
That.
And it must be a difficult recording to listen to. They say that it's very difficult to make out people's speech at times on it because the sound of the wind and the waves and everything that was going on, the chaos around them is so loud. So it must be very difficult to listen to. But yes, apparently, you know, the ship had been taking on water for a number of hours. And then about an hour before the call to abandon ship, actually all the propulsion went out. Mm-hmm. Finally, the captain did call for them to abandon ship. But there's been some questions about why he didn't use that hour more effectively to perhaps prepare people to abandon ship or do something else. We don't have all of the words yet. There will be a transcript made available.
I think what it shows, and this is really kind of just speculation on my part, but I think what it shows is how bad the weather deteriorated in that very short amount of time from, say, 4 in the morning to 7 in the morning. It must have just gone just totally south in terms of the wind and the waves and caught the people on the ship by surprise.
Yeah.
A good thing about they were expecting to get only 16 hours of recordings out of the DVR, but actually they've been able to recover 26 hours. So the timeline leading up to the actual sinking will be more complete than they actually thought it was.
Yeah, and we'll wait to learn more on that. And finally, it's our look at the strange, bizarre, and just plain ridiculous from around the state. Luckily, there is never a shortage of material. Here it is for you right now, only in Florida. Well, only in Florida is a trip to your local Crystal for some burgers potentially life-threatening. Lake City police say a Crystal employee turned violent on Tuesday after learning he would be written up for showing up to work late. 29-year-old Russell Gomez threw frozen hamburger patties at his boss, started knocking over equipment, and even poured cooking oil all over the floor to trip his manager. Employees somehow got customers out of the Crystal safely, while Gomez continued to flip circuit breakers, overturn trash cans, and damage electronic equipment.
Appropriate.
Wow. Only in Florida do neighbors resolve their disputes by weaponizing their cars. 42-year-old Rachel Rowe of Leesburg arrested Monday after she repeatedly drove into her neighbor's fence after telling deputies she was trying to work out a dispute with him. And finally, only in Florida does the Coast Guard have to stop a guy not once, not twice, but three times as he tries to reach Bermuda inside his homemade seafaring hydropod. Have you heard about this?
No.
Bubble Man Reza Bellucci, as he's known, is the endurance athlete who has been trying and trying to reach Bermuda inside a homemade contraption that floats on the waves and looks like a hamster wheel. He pedals. He pedals it. He's trying to get to Bermuda in this little self-contained pod. The Iranian-born Bellucci recently made a third try at this, but was stopped by the Coast Guard and committed to a Jacksonville psychiatric hospital for evaluation. Coast Guard officials say Bellucci threatened to kill himself if they didn't let him continue his journey. He says that when the Coast Guard warned him he could die inside his bubble, he said he was prepared to do so for his cause, raising money for abused kids.
Oh, nice cause.
Yeah. And you have to give him credit for ingenuity. Look at the pictures online. It's really quite something.
I want one of those for Christmas.
We'll be right back. Thanks to our media panel.
I'll race you to Bermuda.
All right.
John Burr, Paula Horvath, Claire Goforth, and Lindsay Kilbride. Thank you all.
Thank you, Melissa.
Back in a moment.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Friday News Roundup, Donald Trump signals a shift in his stance on immigration. After another batch of emails, the Clinton Foundation says it will make changes if Hillary Clinton becomes president, and outrage over the skyrocketing costs of the EpiPen.
At 10 o'clock on 89.9 WJZT, your community, your world.
Hi, I'm John Braun. I'm an emergency planner for the city of Jacksonville, Florida. Individuals with special needs should register annually for assistance with evacuation to shelters. Visit jacksready.com for more information and tune to 89.9, the designated emergency broadcaster for Northeast Florida.
This segment is brought to you by Colo CSX Data Center Hosting Solutions.
WJCT's Goodbye Summer Auction is where you'll find over 300 items, most starting at 75% off at auction.wjct.org. Packages include lodging, attractions, dining, recreation, beauty, and more. Bid now. The auction continues through August 31st at 8 p.m. Log on to auction.wjct.org for more information.
Welcome back. Well, back by popular demand, the soul-stirring Broadway classic The Wiz is on stage this Saturday night at the Ritz Theater. Take a quick listen. We're going to ease on down the road right now with Imelda Kennerly, founder of the Share and Seat Academy for the Performing Arts. They are presenting The Wiz. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good to see you.
Thank you. Good to be here.
This is such a great show. And if people haven't seen it on stage, this is such a great opportunity because, of course, it started on Broadway, then became the hit movie with Diana Ross, Michael Jackson, and then we saw it on TV just last year, which was so exciting.
Yes, it was.
You couldn't pick a more fun show to do. What do you think it is about this production that just gets you? It's just so good.
I think what really gets you is that everybody can relate to it.
Uh-huh.
The smallest children are fascinated, you know, and spellbound. The oldest persons are moved to tears because of the storyline. So it just resonates with everybody.
When it first came out on Broadway and told the story of The Wizard of Oz, but with an all African-American cast, that was revolutionary for its time.
Yes.
And now what you've done is presented this on behalf of the Share and Seed Academy for the Performing Arts. This is a great organization. Can you share a little bit about the mission?
Yes. The mission of the Share and Seed Academy for the Performing Arts is to provide opportunities in the performing arts to children primarily who are in foster care, mm-hmm. and otherwise would not have opportunities to learn to really sing correctly, act, or dance. And they are having a ball. The program has blossomed. And so what we try to do once a year is give them an opportunity to showcase their talents, what they've learned. And so we did The Wiz last year.
Mm-hmm.
It was sold out. Everybody said, you've got to do this again. This is as good as Broadway. Of course, I took that literally. but we thought about it over a few months after debriefing and decided, you know, we want other people to have the opportunity to experience this as well. So that's why we're doing the encore.
There are going to be more than 60 students in the foster care community involved in this year's show. Is that right?
It's 60 students, but they are not all in foster care. We have we have a category called youth ambassadors.
Okay.
So that the foster care kids are not isolated unto themselves, and a lot of we keep the majority of the children in because it's our mission. Who are those children in foster care? But we will accept children who want to perform alongside them, learn alongside them, and we've grown from 13 when we first launched to 62 now.
And kids in the foster care system need all the support they can get. So this is something that people can support not only by coming out to see the show, but you have other opportunities through the year for children as well.
That is correct. We have a year-round academy. Our model is that we are in session on Saturday mornings, with the exception of holidays, of course. And that's where they learn all three of the genre. We've added a fourth, though, because we found out that everyone doesn't want to perform. They like the behind-the-scenes stuff. Oh. So we've added a graphic arts component.
Nice.
And so now all the children are involved.
Well, it's not quite sold out yet, I don't believe. So you still have time to get your tickets to The Wiz tomorrow night, Saturday, August 27th, 7 p.m. at the Ritz Theater, back by popular demand. Sharon Seed Academy for the Performing Arts, the presenting organization. Going to be a great show. Get your tickets at Ticketmaster or the Ritz Theater box office.
Ritz Theater box office. And if people want to pool their resources and get them in a group of 10, they get a $5 discount per ticket.
Very nice. She's founder Imelda Kennerly, and she's going to ease on out of the studio and get ready for this show. Thanks so much for being with us.
Okay, and again, thanks for having me.
We'll be right back.
On the next Fresh Air, Gloria Steinem, now 82, looks back at the different periods of her life. Her memoir is dedicated to the doctor who helped her get an abortion before it was legal and asked that she promise two things.
First, you will not tell anyone my name. Second, you will do what you want to do with your life.
Gloria Steinem on the next Fresh Air. Join us.
Weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
On the next performance today, Jake Shimabukuro joins us in studio.
A lot of times when I tell people that I play the ukulele, you know, they'll say, oh, like that Tiny Tim guy. For me, I embrace that side of the instrument, but at the same time, you can also create very, you know, beautiful and moving music.
Jake Shimabukuro on the next performance today.
Weeknights at 7 on 89.9 WJCT.
Presenting Next Avenue, a website from WJCT created specifically for adults discovering life after 50. Visit us at wjct.org/nextavenue.
Sponsored in part by AARP, Real Possibilities.
Welcome back. Well, finally this hour, it's called the Sing Out Loud Festival, the largest free music fest ever held in St. John's County, ever, with more than 100 free performances by local and national artists. Coming in over the course of 3 weekends, the whole bash begins tonight. We've got a preview right now as we welcome Ryan Murphy and Aubrey Mulligan with the St. Augustine Amphitheater. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Good morning.
And this is the latest success for you guys in a long line of amazing events at the amphitheater. This is free, by the way. And Ryan, let's begin with you. You've got some really good headliners coming in for this. Who all is going to be playing?
So over the course of 3 weekends, it's pretty amazing. We have, tonight, we have the Original Wailers kicking off like a reggae showcase at the backyard at the amphitheater. Next weekend, we have Reverend Peyton. The weekend after that, we have the Indigo Girls, Brandi Carlile, Booker T. Jones, Rhett Miller. It's amazing. It's all free. It's happening in about almost a dozen venues at this point. And it's incredible. Over 130 artists.
Wow. Aubrey, how difficult was it to pull all this off, and how are you making it happen for free? You have a pretty good sponsor, is my understanding.
We do. Community First has been a gracious sponsor and has agreed to sponsor this for the next 2 years after this. So we're very fortunate that they have been so gracious and allowing this entire event to be at no cost for the community.
And this is billed as a St. Augustine celebration of music. So this is something that the community, not just St. Augustine, but especially St. Augustine, is clearly hungering for. You're programming to what people want.
Absolutely. And the biggest thing that I wanted to get across was the fact that these 90-something percent of this is local artists. We're bringing some great Jacksonville artists down too, but for us, it was very St. Augustine, St. John's County centric, and we want to do this as an artist development piece. I want to take the artists of St. Augustine and kind of elevate them to a really cool level, and kind of, I want to see this as like the next South by Southwest for the area.
Oh, really? That's the goal.
The goal is to, in the next couple of years, start incorporating panels and workshops and having artists really talking to each other and have, you know, labels, record labels showing up or booking agents and kind of really helping just, you know, elevate the whole process.
And the amphitheater is a great venue for that, because over the years, your team, both of you and everyone you work with, you've really built a record of success in bringing in high caliber of artists to perform. And what are some of the strategic goals that you've laid out in terms of figuring out who's going to work in this venue? Because it's been a really eclectic group.
It has. I mean, I think really just convincing people, it's hard enough to get people to come to Florida.
Is that hard? They don't want to come when it's hot?
We could say that, but it's also, Florida has a pretty bad reputation in the music industry.
Why is that?
Shady booking agents, weird venues, kind of a climate of, you don't really need to go to Florida.
Oh, wow.
So, I mean, I remember that growing up and really having to drive to Atlanta to see a lot of the bands I wanted to see. So there's been a lot of convincing to come to Florida. And now that they're coming and they see the audiences are growing, there's a really passionate, especially in North Florida. I mean, I'm shocked by having in Jacksonville and St. Augustine the amount of music lovers we have. It's incredible. There's a lot of support.
Yeah, there's a lot of demand for it. Who are some of the local bands that will be part of Sing Out Loud?
Oh, wow, you put me on the spot. Aubrey, you want to answer that?
I'm looking at the schedule on the website. And by the way, the website is just singoutloudfestival.com. This kicks off tonight. There was a little bit of a preview last night, but kicking off tonight with the original Wailers, Solo and the Beat, iVibes, Night Nurse, DJ Ragamuffin, and then who else do we have here? Performances by Emma Mosley Band, the Firewater Tent Revival, Brent Bird, the Grapes of Wrath, Sky Harris, and an after party with Kid You Not. That's not happening? Someone's shaking her head here. Is that still happening?
It's happening.
The after party with Kid You Not, Mustard, Ema and the Old Kings, Joey Kaneva, and Tom McKelvey. Aubrey, who are some of the local standouts that you're excited about?
We're looking forward to everyone, really. But
sure.
Locally, Emma Mosley Band is coming back. They have been performing with us before. What's wonderful is we're actually able to feature a lot of our Sing Out Loud series artists who have worked with this program for years. And so Emma Mosley Band, Ramona Quimby, the Rubies, Shea Burney.
Excellent.
I mean, the list goes on and on. It's incredibly impressive.
And you've got a series of venues, not just the St. Augustine Amphitheater. You're employing venues that range from the Leitner Museum, the Plum Gallery on Avalos Street, the Limelight Theater, Anne O'Malley's Irish Pub, and many more. This is sort of all across the historic district's footprint, it sounds like.
Yeah, and it kind of carries over from what we did originally with Mumford several years ago, and then the 450th last year. We kind of engaged the whole downtown corridor. And we really, I mean, it really gets people behind it by having these many local artists, these many local venues and arts groups and community groups. They really kind of carry the water for all this. And I mean, if no one shows up for this, with the amount of bands coming, it will still be crowded everywhere.
The bands alone.
The bands alone will populate.
And props to Community First Credit Union for underwriting this free event that stretches across 3 weekends in St. Augustine. Sing Out Loud Festival. It kicks off tonight. Just go online to the website, singoutloudfestival.com, and you can reserve seats to the shows you want to see. It is free, but reserve your spot. Ryan Murphy, Aubrey Mulligan, great work as always from the St. Augustine Amphitheater. Have a great time and catch up on your sleep. I'm sure you'll need it at a certain point here in a few weeks.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks again, you guys.
Awesome.
That's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Kevin Merschart. Michelle Corum is running the board. The show theme composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chevchik. Never miss a show. Our podcast is up daily at iTunes and our WJCT app with video on demand at tvjax.com. Diane Reams up next with a look at the week's top national news stories. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. Monday. Have a great weekend.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.